when our young mothers started to stand up with their babies on their hips and say, I don't want my child to ever be governed by the Indian Act and the Minister of Indian Affairs, you knew that the youth wanted something different for their future.
Oh, hallelujah. Oh, hallelujah.
You're listening to the Tree Talk Podcast. Today's topic is Huaya and Tlamen First Nations, with the most updated information as of July 2022. Stay informed and updated with these podcasts as we continue to push the government into negotiating a treaty that is optimal for our community to sign off on.
Everyone, and welcome back to Treaty Talk Podcast. My name is Najalyn Cliff, and I'm the Office Administrator at the Weebukai Treaty Society. This is our fifth episode to date and our latest one since January 5th. These have been a fun way to get some of our treaty information out to our people, and we're continuing to try newer and more interesting topics for our communication plan. Today, we have some special guests joining us on this podcast, and we're happy to invite back our Chief Negotiator, Bram Ruchewski.
Thanks, Najalyn, and it's great to be back on the podcast, and really excited for this episode and the special guests that we have with us. And learning from those who've come before is such an important part of the work. And so I think we're tremendously lucky to have two individuals who have gone through a lot of the stages that we're currently at in terms of our negotiations, and can provide some invaluable words of wisdom and experience for us to consider as we move forward. So really happy to be here. Thanks.
Thanks, Bram. I'd also like to introduce our summer student, Josh Rowland.
Gaelicasa, everyone. Josh Rowland here. I'm the summer student at the Weebukai Treaty Society, and this is my second summer working here. I am a business student at VIU, as well as a Weebukai band member. I'm excited for the podcast, and I'd like to thank our guests for being on today.
Thanks, Josh. Now let's get things rolling, and I'd like to begin to introduce our guests for today's podcast. Each of these guests come from a nation that has signed a modern-day treaty agreement. The experiences and information make this a valuable conversation for our treaty team as well as our band members. So first, I'd like to welcome Angela Rusley. Could you please let the listeners know where you're from and in what capacity you were or currently with in terms of treaty negotiations?
Thank you so much. And thank you for the invitation to participate in this podcast. I'm really excited to be here today. I come from the Huaya First Nations on the west coast of Vancouver Island. We are one of the five signatories to the Monolith First Nations Treaty. So we've been self-governing for 11 years now. I've been involved for pretty much my entire lifetime in trying to find that solution to our lands that were taken away from us many, many years ago. I worked as a land claims coordinator for the New Chamath Tribal Council back in the late 80s. And in the 90s, when the treaty process came about, I started to work with my own nation. I started in a capacity as a negotiator for my own nation and have worked on any number of things that occur during the phases of the treaty negotiation process, whether that's research, technical support, negotiations. I was very involved when we came to ratification of the treaty and also preparing for our self-governance. So it's been a lifelong journey. One of the most proud things I've done in my career is serve as chair of our Constitution Committee for the Huaya First Nations, and very proud to say that our Constitution is standing the test of time up until now, and I look forward to sharing some of our story with you today. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for being here, Angela, and it's great to have you on the podcast. I'd like to now welcome Lori to our podcast. Could you please let the listeners know where you're from and in what capacity you were or are currently with in terms of treaty negotiations?
Hi, thank you for having me today. My name is Lori Wilson, and I'm from the Tlamen Nation. And we are in year 6 of our treaty, and pre-treaty, I was at post-secondary. So my involvement with the treaty process was as a community member. It was constant community engagement and surveys and workshop, just, you know, being a part of the dialogue. And then our treaty passed in 2016. And I moved home from when I graduated from UBC in 2013. and I became an elected counselor in 2014. So I was in that last term under the Indian Act. I did one term under the Indian Act, and then we crossed over into the treaty, treaty effective date. And then I've been an elected counselor for the last 6 years. So my portfolio was finance and administration. For the first 5 years, it was lands and resources. And my involvement with treaty was, we did a lot of policy and law writing for 2 to 3 years before the treaty came in. So I sat on those meetings, and now today we are implementing the treaty. And I think the most important part is developing really strong policies and processes. And that's the most important part that I'm seeing right now since treaty effective date, is that we need really strong policies to govern ourselves. And that's what we're working towards right now. Yeah, so my political portfolio right now is finance and administration. So that's the main area I focus on. Thank you.
We are grateful to have you two on the podcast today. I know that there will be some valuable discussion here for our nation's members. So my first question for you all is, what the process was like, and when getting your treaty signed, what are the main challenges that come to mind? I'll ask Angela first.
Well, honestly, the whole process was a challenge, Josh. the biggest stumbling block, I think, in negotiations or negotiations in the modern treaty process, and it's not a secret to anybody, is really the limited mandates of Canada and BC. It's not a typical negotiation process where you have a lot of back and forth and there's a lot of creativity. Certainly that's happening more now. There have been amazing breakthroughs in the treaty process, and your nation is lucky to be the beneficiary of some of those after so many years. We found that a lot of the issues that were standing in our way in getting to that final closing, aside from just getting to that point of making that final decision of yes, we're there, are the issues that have been addressed now. Things like, you know, the finality of treaties, the fiscal arrangements, taxation, clawback of own source revenues, loan repayment, all of those kind of things. And you look now, 10 years later, and every single one of those has been addressed. So even the taxation announcement that came out last week was phenomenal. That is something I'm hoping is really going to move the treaty process forward. But I think that something that we've always said, and when I talk to communities about our experience and the quote full and final treaty that we've been under, it really isn't. In my view, it never has been, even before all of those advancements. I think it's really important for people to know, you know, when I used to go to communities, I'd say to people, like, get more than what we got, because certainly we're going to be benefiting from those as well. And that's been proven. Our fiscal arrangements in our communities have skyrocketed since we signed that full and final agreement. We've been able to go back to the table to negotiate greater fiscal arrangements. Loan repayments have been forgiven, where our loans are going to be repaid what has been paid of them so far. The taxation announcement, there's just so many improvements that have been made. And we found that throughout the treaty process, when we were in agreement in principle with more tribes at the New Channel Tribal Council, a lot of the nations didn't approve of the agreement in principle at that time. This was back in about 2000, because things like the recognition of our hereditary chiefs wasn't part of all of that. The fisheries amounts weren't to what we thought they were. The five nations that voted in favor of the agreement in principle at that time saw a huge increase in all of those areas when we got to the final agreement. So in my view, it continues to be a living process. We negotiated treaties, we're in living arrangements and partnerships with our treaty partners of Canada and BC, and we're getting a lot of attention through the Alliance of Modern Day Treaties, meeting with the Premier, meeting with the Prime Minister, participating in all of those functions and tables that are continuing to advance. What we wanted to do is to make our world a better place going forward. So I think that, you know, this whole notion of living treaties is just a real advancement for nations that are in the treaty process right now. And it feels so good to be in control of our own lives.
That's a big topic, and idea that I see around here, especially, is the living and breathing document and an agreement. So yeah, thank you. Lori.
I agree with Angela on everything she said. We also went through those topics and experiences too. And I think that taxation and the tax exemption and losing that status tax exemption card, I think that was the biggest topic that divided our community. You know, we were just so used to the status tax exemption. And then there's 60% of our nation members living here at home and 40% living everywhere, from Vancouver Island to the Vancouver Lower Mainland to Alberta. And then we have a large group down across the border, you know, and then we have like scattered Australia, Ontario, down in Georgia. We have, you know, membership scattered everywhere. So people were really divided on losing the tax exemption because it affected them all in different ways because of where they lived. The group that live here, they really utilize their tax exemption. And then our membership who live on Vancouver Island and Vancouver Lower Mainland utilize their tax exemption card. So it, you know, also has to do with tax coming off your paycheck. So it affected people in different ways, and that's what divided our people. So I guess taxation is the biggest, was the biggest impact that we, you know, had dialogue and engagement and division over. Yeah, so there was a big announcement. I actually just read the news release before this podcast. I would really keep my eye on that tax exemption. The federal minister, Mark Miller, said he's going to, I think, extend or accommodate or try to support us in that area. So there's a commitment from the federal minister. So I'm really happy to hear about that. And then I remember back in, I was still going to school around 2007 or 8. Maybe it was 2009 when like a large portion of First Nations pulled out of the treaty process because of the, I think the criteria or the requirement was that we take a loan to go through the treaty process. And I remember like, I don't know, 50 or 100 First Nations pulling out of the treaty process because they didn't like that stipulation. So I wasn't part of the negotiations. I was just, a post-secondary student away at school. And I remember our nation stayed in the treaty process. And from my point of view, I just saw our nation just kind of put that political thing on the back burner, and they just kept going forward with their treaty process. And I think that was like a really smart move. And I'm very happy and proud of our nation for doing that. I can't take any credit for that because I wasn't involved. But now that we do have the treaty, you know, we have this very formal relationship. BC and Canada, you know, have to fly up from their headquarters to come walk in our boardroom and sit across the table from us and listen to our concerns and comments and take our dialogue very seriously. And it comes with funding because you can't have agreements without funding. So yeah, I'm very proud of what our nation has accomplished so far. And I'm really happy that we do have this treaty.
Josh, if I could, I think that Lori hit on something that's, you know, in terms of the challenge, when you're getting close to the end of your negotiations, it really becomes that difficult place where you've got to make the decision is, can we move forward with this? And for us, it meant a lot of, Lori talked about it as well, you know, a lot of things that, you know, those bitter pills to swallow. We had to make a conscious decision to say, okay, we need to move forward, because we were looking for the tools in the treaty toolbox that were going to help us to rebuild our society in our way. And we didn't see any way that that could happen under the Indian Act system. So one of the challenges is really getting yourself to that place where you say, you know, is there a balance? We'll talk a little bit later on, or maybe I'll have a chance to talk a little bit later on of how we've moved forward in our community and in nation and starting to make those kind of improvements. And those are improvements that we don't think we could ever have made under the Indian Act. So getting to that decision is a tough thing to do, but you need to feel confident as a negotiating team and as leaders to be able to say, yes, this is something we can work with.
Right. Of course. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I think, and I guess this is demonstrates how cutting edge this podcast series is, because a week ago I was going to ask you guys, how do we get through the issue of the loss of the tax exemption? And here we are talking in light of the announcement just at the end of last week about maintaining the tax exemption. And I think, Angela, it goes really to your point around what's happened over the last several years in terms of those really key impediments to being able to move forward and to get to that comfortable place, as you've articulated it, and those impediments to ratification. If we talk about the move from kind of the non-assertion model into a title recognition model, the movement from kind of us frozen in time to now having the periodic renewal where we can reopen the treaty at segments to see really how it's doing. Is it achieving the outcomes? And if not, how can we maneuver to ensure that it does? The loan forgiveness. And then, of course, now what's happening on taxation, really those crucial impediments. I think there's been some success and really, you know, having you gone before us. And Laurie, you know, I know when we talked, we had the opportunity of being part of this working group of lead tables. I was working with Finance Canada on this tax exemption issue and being able to use, I think, some of your experience, particularly in community that we had heard about people that had been that it believes so strongly in treaty and indeed been part of the negotiating process, but yet had to make that really, really difficult decision about whether even to enroll in the treaty or not because of what it meant for their livelihood and their family and their ability to continue to thrive and just realizing how tangible that and how difficult those decisions were. So, you know, I think this really is a breakthrough. And I guess my question, which was going to be how we overcome that hurdle, I guess maybe now I'll repurpose the question and just ask what you think, being in this place now where we understand that citizens will be able to maintain their exemption. We feel like we're getting to a place even on property tax with British Columbia where the nation will be able to exercise its jurisdiction on property tax, but also be in a position to continue to exempt citizens who have had the benefit of that exemption. I guess I was going to ask, number one, what you think that might mean for ease of ratification for future treaties that will be coming forward, number one. And number two, what that means from a governance perspective, having that flexibility around being able to take that jurisdiction over taxation, which we know is important, but also maintain that exemption, which is so important to your citizens. So maybe I'll just repurpose the question a bit that way for either of you or both of you. Thanks.
Well, we have just recently this term, this elected term, we formed a taxation committee or working group, and we're looking, because we were about 2 or 3 years away from terminating our tax exemption. So we've been chewing on it for maybe about a year now or almost a year now. And I've learned a lot. Like, we've only had a few meetings and there's so much on taxation and we're just scratching the surface on it. There's not only property tax, there's corporate tax. So I guess my advice to you would be to ask or try to negotiate a corporate tax where, you know, you could have a business head office corporation on your treaty settlement lands so that you can receive that corporate tax. Because in our treaty, it's, I think it's just property tax, but there's like 100 different taxes. And they only put property tax, I think, in, and individual income tax, I believe. So very minimal. They went very minimal. But now that we're really looking at taxation, there's so many different taxes. So I just suggest that you get your lawyers to really look over the whole array of taxes, because we didn't do that and we didn't know any better. So the taxation chapter was just a top-down type of a negotiation. I guess maybe I'll let Angela chime in and maybe I'll think of some other things that we're going through. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Lori. It's so correct. And you're in a better position than me to be talking about the financial and taxation aspects of things. But you're quite right that the announcement that is being talked about right now is the Section 87 exemption, which only deals with transaction taxes and income tax. But there are so many other areas of taxation that need to be discussed. And you've pointed some out, you know, very well. There are tax treatment agreements as well that are associated with our treaty, and I'm sure Tawasin has those as well. And I'm not the expert to say in how those work, but there are provisions for us to receive property taxes, for example, from people who are residing on our treaty settlement lands, to have a share of income taxes of people that are residing on our lands come back to us to finance our government and to be able in a better position to provide services. So there's a lot more to the taxation issue than just Section 87. But of course, as citizens, you know, when we're under the Indian Act, we feel like that's one of the only things that we've got to us. So taking it away from us feels, you know, very invasive. So it's a huge issue for citizens. We have gotten to the point now where we are paying transaction taxes in my community, and coming up on that date where we would have had to pay income tax. I think that is all yet to come. You know, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done to really figure out what that means for modern treaty nations. I actually think that those that are negotiating are in a really good position to be defining a little bit better how that's going to work for them. So your nation, you know, in this stage of your negotiations, this is a real coup for you to really be able to talk that through. Just, you know, maybe if the question was the original one, Bram, I think that when we talked about taxation, we talked a lot also about our history and how we survived as a community and as a nation before. And that was all around sharing. You know, today they call that taxation, but taxation is really about sharing the wealth, making sure that everybody is taken care of. And if we related that as we did when we were talking about taxation, is that when we had our fishermen go out, we had people whose job it was to go out and get halibut or to go out and get salmon or to go out and get different kinds of resources. In our tradition and in our history, those resources came back to our chiefs, our chiefs, and they made sure that that was redistributed in a way that everybody would receive benefit because other people were doing other jobs. If their responsibility was even just to get firewood, and that's not just to, but they would bring that back and that would be distributed as well. So that was the nature of our societies, is that we shared, and that was our form of taxation at that time, to make sure that the whole nation would benefit from the resources that were happening and that there was that fair distribution and that people were taken care of. So when we think about taxation, it's really important to think about that aspect of it too. And maybe in a modern context, the ability to generate revenue through taxation. My community is pretty remote, so we're really not there in terms of being able to have that good revenue source through taxation. But I have to think that Tawasin in particular, living in a very urban area, that creates a huge revenue source for them and Tlam. And I know that you've got some leased lands as well. So you're sort of on that same road. Hopefully we will be too at some point. And those are all the things that we need to figure out over time. But taxation is, as you've pointed out, Lori, is bigger than just Section 87. There's a lot of things to be talking about and having some great minds around to give us some advice and some experiences from modern treaty nations of, you know, what worked, what hasn't worked, and what kind of advice would you have is really beneficial to you in moving forward as well.
Great discussions. Thank you, guys. Can you guys describe, and maybe Angela, you can start with this one, but can you describe the transition period, the time in between signing and implementation of the treaty, and how many years did your nation take, and do you feel it was too fast, too soon, just right, or, you know, maybe any kind of suggestions that you might have?
I remember the whole process of being lots and lots and lots of work and lots of people needing to contribute to that. So it's a really great time to build capacity and to have citizens being involved in those processes, in the working groups. We took about, I would say, about 3.5 years, and that was longer than Tawasin and probably Tla'aman as well. We had some complications in our process around some of our nations still being involved in fisheries litigation and how we were going to decide whether or not we would give that up, because we were forced to give up our place at that table if we were going to sign the treaty. So that took a lot of thinking on our part. So eventually we did. But during that 3.5 year period, you know, we did a lot of learning. We had working groups in fiscal and finance, in wildlife, in governance, internal governance, permitting, documentation, all of those things that we'd have to make laws on. It was a real learning experience, and it was really valuable for capacity building. So I would say to you that it's a really great time to have your citizens become involved, because you want your citizens to be the ones who are doing the work for you. When we started our treaty, it wasn't like that. We had to look outside because we were spending so much time on negotiations and getting ready that we really didn't have the time to be doing that capacity building. So this is a really great opportunity, even now, for your nations to start bringing people in as you can, to start to expose them to what's happening in treaty, to get them used to thinking about what a self-governing world is going to look like, and to be a huge part of that, because that's what we got into this for, was to make our world a better place, to provide employment for our people, to be in control of our own lives. And it's really important for us to do that. So I couldn't say whether it was too long or not long enough. You know, 3.5 years was a long time compared to others that ratified or signed in the same time frame that we did. But we took up every minute of that time. And if we had another year, we would have taken up every minute of that time as well. But it's like negotiations. At some point, you've just got to say, let's just do this thing. You know, you've got to set a date and do it. It was interesting because I was doing a lot of community engagement, not only with my nation, but also with the four other nations that were part of the Monmouth Treaty. And I went to one assembly and their administrator got up and said, you know what? We worry about effective date being, you know, at that time, maybe it was 6 months from now. She said, but we know ourselves, we know our history, and we know what we can do. She said, if effective date was tomorrow, we would be ready. And I absolutely agree with her. We can do this. It's, you know, it takes a lot of stumbling and falling and figuring out how to do things and learning from our mistakes, but that's what self-government is all about. So diving in and doing it is the best way to figure out how to get it done. And as I said, there's so many precedents now, there's so many lessons learned. We learned from the Nisga, we learned from Tawasin, who came before us, and it was invaluable. And what I see now in our, what I call the treaty family, is that that pay it forward attitude is always there. And those who are implementing modern day treaties and living in self-governing worlds are so willing to not tell you how to do things, but to share the experiences so that you can learn from them and do things in whatever way makes sense for your community.
I recall the first term, kind of like the dust was still settling. I remember like reaching like the 6 month mark after we signed the treaty and we didn't feel any different. And we kind of just went with the flow. And we implemented the treaty kind of like on example by example basis. So I guess the whole first term, which was 4 years, yeah, we were still just letting the dust settle, I guess. But now this term, which we're just reaching the halfway mark of this term, we've created like about at least 25 new positions in our office that weren't there before. So this term we really were really aggressive or assertive at implementing the treaty. And we started looking at where were the bottlenecks of our governance for the programs and services to our people that weren't being effective or were missing or there was a gap. So we've created at least 25 new positions in the last 2 years that weren't there before. Where we need help implementing the treaty, we look at that role and, you know, our community plan or nation, the strategic plan that we have. So I guess that's another thing. If you don't have a strategic plan for your nation, you should start working on that. And then that will, you'll create an org chart, organization chart, and then have it all on paper, like as a visual where you need implementation. We're just going through a big growth spurt to address implementing the treaty. So that's one example. Any other examples right now? But I guess that's the first one that comes to my mind.
Can I ask a quick follow-up question, Nadj and Josh, just about that period of time between a decision on the part of your nation to ratify the treaty and that period of time up until the effective date? And Angela, you expressed, I think, the sheer volume of work that took place during that 3.5 year period or whatever that period might be. From the perspective kind of paying it forward, and this will be maybe the first, but not the last time we knock on your door to ask all sorts of advice. But one of the things we understand and learned is that that startup period was was not well supported from a funding perspective, because you kind of have that weird place where your maybe your BC Treaty Commission support ends at the time of ratification, but you aren't implementing your treaty. So your fiscal relationships haven't kicked in yet. So you have this gap. And I know that's one of the things we've been talking to Canada about from the fiscal perspective in terms of startup costs and really supporting all of that work. And I recognize your advice around making sure that a lot of that happens even before that period as we're bringing citizens forward and thinking about capacity development and how we're going to fill all of those positions. But any suggestions or advice about how we can really focus in on that period and also make sure it's funded adequately so that the nation can do the good work it needs to do to really get ready for effective date? I was just going to ask, you know, how you dealt with that, if that was a challenge, and how we might be able to overcome that during our process.
Thanks, Bram. I wasn't the expert in that area in my community, but my recollection is it's exactly that. There was no specific funding. There was some startup funding that was available. I recall our leaders at the time saying that we had to actually draw upon future funding in order to finance that period of time. So yeah, it's really critical to be able to have that period of time funded. I'm not sure, it may be that the Treaty Commission funding for stage six of implementation may extend beyond now that point. It wasn't available to us at that time. And I understand it was because of the loan funding and the calculations that had to be done around that and the amounts that had to be put in the treaty. So I think that with that gone, there may be some funding there as well, but it is a very costly process. I actually know that there's been some work done by Dylan, I think from Plum, and has done some work in costing out some of those things as well. And it's a lot of work, and it's really worth sort of pressing to make sure that you've got adequate funding for that period of time.
Yeah, I don't remember the exact name, but I do know there was at least two different pots of money for implementing the treaty that we used. I think I remember gap funding. I don't know if that was just a name we called it or if it was part of a title. So yeah, there was a couple of agreements, I guess I'll call agreements, that we had for implementation. But I'm sorry, I don't remember the names of it. Yeah, but yeah, Angela's right. Dylan was our finance. He was involved heavy in the finance area. But yeah, it is worth it to look into what we did and the other nations did to do with finance and funding at the treaty effective date.
I'm fortunate enough to know Dylan a little bit, so I can follow up as well. Thank you.
Another question that I have for you two is, how did your communities change after you signed your treaties? And this perspective could be as a community member or a leader in both your treaty and your community as well.
You know, with creating, you know, 25 or more new positions that weren't there before, our administration office went through change management. So we hired a professional HR consultant, and yeah, we're just going through that. Just policies and meetings and just supporting our people, our staff. And getting good work out of our staff is all about having a good relationship. So, you know, we want our staff to have good relationships with each other so they can be productive, and for elected leadership and managers and staff to have good relationships every which way we can. So I guess, we just seeked consultant support.
Now, thanks for the question, Josh. I think that a lot has changed in our community, being 11 years self-governing now. Tend to always focus on the positive and the rosy sides of things, because I just am a true fan of where we've gone in a very short period of 11 years. But there's, you know, there's challenges as well that we have. But if the question is, have our lives changed? Absolutely, yes, they have changed for the better in 11 years. It's really important for citizens to know, and it's important to communicate to this, I think, during the ratification, to be truly honest. You know, it's not a light switch. Life doesn't change immediately after treaty. All of a sudden, you're living in this rosy world. The treaty as the negotiation team, we always used to say the treaty was our toolkit. It's what's going to help us to rebuild our nation the way we want to rebuild it. That's going to take a lot more than, for example, the cash part that's in the treaty. We're going to have to be able to generate revenues so that we can bring our programs and services and provide services to our citizens to a level that we would like to. That can't happen overnight. But what we were always looking at is there enough tools in the treaty for us to develop our own economy, to create new revenues in addition to what's in the treaty, for us to be able to achieve those priorities that we have for ourselves. My uncle, who's been our long-serving chief counselor for Hawaii, always says self-government, priceless. You know, he looks at all, you know, how much did you get in land? How much did you get in cash and everything else? And he says the biggest part of our treaty was that ability to be self-governing. So how we use those tools then is all up to us. The land that's in the treaty, the cash that's in the treaty, the governing powers that are in the treaty, and how we use that to make our lives and our world a better place is going to be up to us at the end of the day. A lot of the questions that we got during ratification were, well, what's going to change for housing? How's housing going to work? How's education going to work? How's forestry going to work on our lands? The answer to all of those things is it's up to us. The treaty doesn't tell us how those things are going to work. It's up to us. Lori just talked about strategic planning. Bang on. That's where your community decides what your priorities are. And that's how you decide how you're going to move forward and make the treaty work for you and the tools that are in the treaty. So our treaty and I think our experience, some of the good things that have happened, self-government, a say in our own lives, setting our own priorities is priceless in terms of what the treaty has brought to us and brought back our own self-government and our ability to take care of ourselves. Rebuilding the economy in our home territories, we're taking great strides in being the ones who are reviving Bamfield and area. People come to us, they know that we're the ones that are starting to make the difference in our territory, in a territory and little village that was really fading away. You know, it used to be a really thriving fishing village and it wasn't anymore. So us having the ability to bring back that presence, to be there, knowing we're going to be there for the long term was huge. So people, not only our citizens, but the people who are residing in the area are feeling the difference. Similar to what Lori said, the majority of our population lived away from home. One of our strategic priorities was to bring our people back home. I'm seeing housing going up in our community like crazy. We've probably doubled our population in 11 years. And actually, that's probably only happened in the last 2 years. So there was a lot of restlessness in the first few years of saying, you know, you said life was going to get better for us. How come we don't have housing? How come we don't have jobs? How come we don't have schools? All of those things take time. But that means that you've got to have population. You've got to have critical mass to be able to have those things back in your community. So that comes from bringing people home, which was always part of our strategic priority. So we've got tremendous amount of housing. We've got young families moving back home, which means we're going to have to step it up in terms of providing recreational facilities, health facilities, education facilities. So there's still a lot that we need to do, but people are starting to move home. And that's a big difference from what it was 11 years ago. I'm seeing a lot of different types of programs and services being offered to our people with our flexibility and our ability to have more revenue with which to say how it works. We've always been under sort of block funding agreements or being able to decide where that money goes for many years before treaty, but we have now more funding. So we have flexibility to offer really great wellness, what I would call culture and wellness programs for our citizens. I'm seeing, you know, weekly cultural nights, and by Zoom now we're able to include more people in there. We are offering different kinds of programming to people who live in urban areas, men's nights, women's nights, girls programs, cultural camps. All of these things are just thriving. My community just had a cultural camp this past week. There was more than 100 people at the camp. It was just amazing. We didn't have 100 people living in our community 11 years ago. That's huge. So those kind of differences are really big. A lot that brings a lot of pride that people are now reconnecting with our community, and it's a really great thing. We provide benefits to our elders on a monthly basis to help them to alleviate some of the costs that they've got. It's just, excuse me, the list goes on and on of all of the different areas where we're slowly taking those steps forward. They're not huge steps, but they're little steps. Education has opened up. We could never get funding for trades training before. That's a priority for us now. We know not all of our people want to go into post-secondary programs. Trades is excellent. We need trades people. We now fund trades people, and we have that flexibility to be able to do those kind of things. I was watching a virtual presentation my community held an old growth summit virtually about 2 or 3 months ago, and I was astounded. I know of all the things that have been going on, and our chief counselor sort of keeps a tally on how we're doing, because when we were in treaty, we told our people, we've got a formula. We're going to have exclusive territories, and we're going to have shared territories and jurisdiction, and that's going to equal our entire territories. So, because our hereditary chiefs and some of our highest critics were saying, we need to have it all. We need to have it all back. And of course, we knew we couldn't get it all back, but this is how we thought we could do it. So when we got to treaty, we weren't there. We were probably about maybe 18 or 20% when we counted up all the interests that we have. At that summit, they showed a slide of our territories, 91%. 91% of our territory we have a say over now. That's far from the 10% that we hear people talking about what's available in the treaty process. We've got our treaty settlement lands, we have forest tenures, we have purchased fee simple lands right in Bamfield to start businesses there. We've purchased other lands which we knew were set aside in the treaty for us to purchase. We agreed to purchase lands where trees would grow back. We allowed forest companies to take the trees for this generation. We're going to be here for the long run, so we'll take those lands after they're logged. They'll be cheaper for us to purchase, and we're going to be here when those trees are ready to be harvested, and we get to manage them in the meantime as well as that area regrows. So there's a lot of things that we've done. The biggest piece, I guess, was us buying into TFL 44, and that's covered a lot of our territory as well. So you may know about that. So there's a lot of benefits, I think, that have come to our community since treaty, and it comes with a lot of hard work. It comes with a lot of stress because you're still not dealing with a whole lot of revenue to do this with. So there's a lot of financial planning that has to be done around that, but the possibilities are really tremendous under treaty. Some of the challenges that we're facing, and that has to do with that period you asked about earlier between ratification and effective date when you're setting your laws, we're finding that we overregulated ourselves. We were so excited about having a say in doing things that, yeah, everything that should go to membership and they should go here first before the government is allowed to do that. It's really important during that period to figure out how you're going to allow your government to govern effectively with the proper oversight and accountability from citizens. And that balance needs to be reflected in laws. One of the things we're finding is that for some things, it takes us forever to get the simplest decision, because we decided in our laws that it had to go to the People's Assembly first. Well, the People's Assembly only is held once a year. You have to hold a special People's Assembly if you want to get something passed through there. It's very costly to hold a People's Assembly. So those realities, we were so excited about being self-governing and everybody having to say that in many cases we overregulated ourselves. But self-government being priceless means that we can change our laws without having to talk to 600 other First Nations across Canada and do that. They're our laws and we can make them, adjust them so that they work for us. So sorry to sort of carry on a little bit long, but those are some of the changes that we're seeing in our community 11 years into treaty.
If I can add a little bit more. So the Indian Act and all their programs and services, the programs and the funding for those programs, the criteria is so narrow that our needs were outside of that criteria. So all the programs and services that come from the Indian Act as a pre-treaty nation, they were not addressing our needs for like health and dental programs for us. We're going narrower and narrower. Like they're cutting down every year, cut back. So yeah, that's why it's like First Nations are living in poverty under the Indian Act, because all the programs and services are so narrow. Like there's so many things about supporting our people that are beyond what the Indian Act criteria is. So that was one of the driving factors for us to go through the treaty process, is that we know what we need. We know how to provide for our people. We know what they need. And the Indian Act was going less and less. And then we wanted to be in charge of our own programs and services and have our criteria cover all our people's needs. So that's probably the biggest thing about the treaty, is that We decide for ourselves what programs and services to give our people, not what the Indian Act, what INAC, what they're called now, ISC, ISC, not them to tell us what we're going to have. So through own source revenue, additional funding, we just get increased funding, increased agreements. We have the ability for economic development that's a big one. We want land rich and cash poor. That's what our negotiators call it. So we have 60 kilometers of ocean waterfront. We have 5,500 hectares of fee simple forestry. And, you know, we have the means to make our own money and to use our revenue on what we want. So I think that's the greatest thing about the treaty agreement.
Thank you both. Treaty is such a huge change, and some of our members fear change. How did you go about getting your community involved in a process they could be unsure about? Our youth are a really difficult group to reach. Angela, you mentioned that you did some community engagement work in the treaty negotiation process. So maybe you can tell us some of the ways that you were able to get people involved and/or read the materials that you guys were sending out so that they could make an informed decision when the time came.
We did a lot of community engagement throughout all of the Manoth communities during the ratification process and throughout treaty and during our constitution as well. We really found that the best way of reaching out to people was one-on-one. As difficult and as costly as that is, the most reaction and the best benefit that you get is just from sitting down and having a cup of coffee with people. That might be, you know, heads of family, it might be anybody in your community, people who encourage people to pass it on, create an environment where people feel comfortable asking the tough questions or telling you what they feel uncomfortable about so that you can help them to understand what the facts are. Quite often people are making assumptions about what they hear, and it's hard to get, not everybody learns in the same fashion. You know, some are visual learners, some need to watch videos, some want to read things, some want a lot of detail, some want a high overview. It's really such a combination. I've done whole workshops on communication and engaging communities. It's one of the most expensive and most important things that you can do is to keep connected with your community and make sure that they're making an informed decision. If it's no, that's okay, as long as they're making it based on an informed and factual set of materials. It's so important when people start to engage. To talk about the youth specifically, we had youth involved pretty much all along, and they stepped up to the plate. I don't know if it was on their own. I don't know how we empowered them, but they just felt so responsible for this decision when it came down to it. And I think it's because we opened the door more and more, allowed them to come in, allowed them to ask their questions, found ways that they wanted to engage. One of the bigger things that we did as five Manoth communities together is we held a big youth forum at the University of Victoria, because we wanted to also expose our young people to post-secondary. So they stayed in the dorms. We had access to the lecture theaters there. We had youth involved in doing the planning so that they could talk about what they wanted to talk about, not what we thought they should talk about or what they should learn. So they felt really responsible for being a part of that. And I think that we engaged so many youth in that process that they really took it on after that. They wanted to be part of the negotiating teams. They wanted to understand what this meant for their future. There was a lot of our elderly people who just couldn't get there. They had lived their lives under the Indian Act. This was just too far out there for them to see how it was going to work. They'd been through so much in their experiences through residential schools or whatever other terrible things they'd gone through in their lives. They just couldn't see it happening in a lot of cases. So it was the young people at the end that were telling their parents and their grandparents, I want this. I want this for me. I see a brighter future here, and this is really what I want. When our young mothers started to stand up with their babies on their hips and say, I don't want my child to ever be governed by the Indian Act and the Minister of Indian Affairs, you knew that the youth wanted something different for their future. And I think they do. The youth of today are so brilliant. They've got such open minds. So empower them to become involved, empower them to take it on, because they're the ones that are going to be implementing the treaty at the end of the day. And our youth turn into middle-aged folks really fast too. So it's an ongoing process, right? I had to remind myself I wasn't a youth anymore at some point during this whole process, because others come in, generations come in. There's no magic formula of how to do it, but creating that environment for young people to be involved and to use their voices and to have their say and to be a part of the vision that, you know, as Lori said, comes out of your strategic plan. All of that has to be grounded in the community. That vision has to be shared by everybody. And the youth have to talk about what it is that they see for their future and for their children that they're starting to have as young people now too. So just giving them a space, challenging them to do that. It's difficult because youth have got so much going on in their lives right now too. But I think that if they see that they've got a place there, that they're being heard, and that this is all about them and their futures, they step up to the plate pretty quickly.
I agree with Angela. Asking them, you know, what do they want to understand? What do they want to know? And listening to them and making sure they're sincerely being heard. For our youth, I don't recall. I attended all the community engagements. I think just involving them in the planning. I think the strategic planning would be a good way to engage with them. Yeah, I think that's my best advice for that. Thanks.
Lori, you probably don't know, but I did some work with La'aman during your ratification process, and you had a young team of people on your ratification team. They were amazing. I would stop in every now and then, and the youth would come in just bubbling. You know, they had their iPhones. They knew about all this technology that none of us old folks knew anything about, and they just decided what they wanted to do. Oh, today we're going to go out. We're just going to stop people on the street. We're going to interview them with our iPhones. And they were having these interviews, you know, sort of youth on the street, and they'd stop people and talk to them. And they were having so much fun with it. It was hard for, I think, anybody not to be consumed by their enthusiasm. So just letting them do what they know intuitively, how to ask the questions, how to do that work, having them as part of the team and having them understand how meaningful that is, really is a great place for youth to be in the whole process.
Well, thank you both so very much. We appreciate your participation, your words of advice. This has been very informative, especially for our members to be able to hear from both of you and your experiences with treaty, post-treaty. And, you know, a final thanks to all the listeners for tuning in. And if you guys have any questions, please reach out to us at info@wewakaitreaty or give us a call at the office at 250-287-9460.
Awesome. That's a wrap. Thank you guys so much.